Accession number 32297, reel 11.
John Dixon, reel 11. John, can you tell me something about how you got back on the troop ship? And
Obviously at some stage while we were at Moncton, we must have been told to pack our bags because we were off. Nobody tells you where, but they obviously got a train into the station and away we went. It turned out that we went to Halifax and we got on board a troop ship which was called the Louis Pasteur. Presumably it was a French ship when it started, but it was well and truly battered and bashed. It was well, in naval parlance, it was not much more than a rust bucket. It was uncomfortable, but at least we knew we were on our way home. But it was presumably January 1944. And it was pretty atrocious weather, and we didn't have a very comfortable crossing, but we made it.
What were conditions like on board?
Well, not very good. I can't remember too many of the details, but obviously we were herded. I jokingly say we were kept in the hold, but we were certainly not in cabins. We were obviously in bunk beds, and we did have to do some sort of ship's duties, which I think basically just meant lookouts in case any submarines happened to be about. But in that sort of weather, I don't think we'd have seen anything anyway. But I've got a snapshot somewhere of a chum of mine taken, and we got our sailors' hats on, but we had the chin straps down underneath. But it was pretty foul weather.
How long did it take you to get back on board the Louis Pasteur?
Well, it was a bit more than 4 days, and I can't be sure exactly how long it took us to get back, maybe a week. But all I do remember is when we got back, where were we going? Nobody tells you where you're coming to, but we actually came into Liverpool, and it's the first time I'd seen the Liverbird building. And it was pretty dreadful weather. It was murky and it was drizzly and it was raining and, oh dear. And England in wartime was very different from what we've been used to. So although we were overjoyed to be home, we were a bit depressed in some ways.
What did they do when you arrived at Liverpool?
On a train. Go north. Where were we going? Nobody knew. But we ended up at a northern outskirts of Liverpool, at a place called Bootle, which was I don't know what it had been before. It had been some sort of government set up, because they were just single story rows of brick buildings, most unattractive place, and it rejoiced in the name of HMS Macaw. And so we sat there in this dreadful weather, and we awaited what was going to happen.
How did that pan out? What was the?
Well, obviously we were all on tenterhooks as to whether we were going to get commissions or not, and I think eventually we were summoned into a hut or a hall or something, and a list was put up. And it just gave a list of names. These were going to be temporary acting sub-lieutenants. And in my case, I was going to be a temporary acting midshipman. This was purely and simply because of my age. You had to be 20 years old to become a sub-lieutenant. And unfortunately, there were probably 8 or 10 that were going to be acting petty officers. I say unfortunately, one shouldn't be too disparaging about, but it was disappointing in that all through our training we'd always, that was our number two priority. Number one, get your wings, and number two, get your commission. So there were these chaps that didn't get their commissions initially. They did, I think they nearly all did eventually. Probably 6 months or a year further down the line, they did get their commissions.
I know we discussed this slightly off the tape, but was there any reasoning that you could see at that time why some people were made petty officers and some people were made officers or midshipmen?
Absolutely no way at all of knowing, Richard. I don't think anybody can ever put their finger on it. As I've said before, we all had this OLQ, officer-like qualities. We were watched all through our training. But when I think of some of these chaps that were made petty officers, I mean, my particular chum, Graham, was a minor public school boy. He was smart, he was dapper, he was always immaculately turned out. He spoke well, and I could think of no reason at all why they shouldn't give him a commission.
Could it have been a percentage type thing? A certain percentage of people would have had to have been petty officers.
I couldn't answer that. I mean, presumably somebody up in the hierarchy must have decided that this should happen. And again, the thing that struck me as very unfair were two things. One, of course, was that if you had trained as an observer and you'd achieved your wings, your observer's wings, you became an officer. There was no question of becoming a petty officer. And if you were one of the group that was trained in America at Pensacola, once they knew you were about to get your wings, you were given your commission then. You actually got your commission before you got your wings. No petty officers out there.
At that stage, then, what happens once you received the thought that you're going to be commissioned?
Well, of course, we were overjoyed, those of us that were that had got that notification. I think I'm right in saying we were given a cheque for £55 to equip ourselves as officers. Now, that doesn't sound very much money in today's terms, but you think back to 1943, that was a lot of money. £55. The other thing that I do remember was that we were beset by a swarm of Taylor's representatives. They descended on us like flies. And I can remember there was one firm called All Kit. And they just rushed at you and said, "Well, we'll measure you up, sir. We'll get your uniform all ready, and I mean, we'll have it within days. Everything will be done for you. Just give us the authority, and we'll do it." And of course, a lot of people, I don't say fell for it. They did it quite realistically, for the reason that we were all going to go on leave. We knew that. And if they lived a long way away from any sort of establishment where there could be a naval tailors, well, obviously they availed themselves of All Kit. But I was coming back to Esher in Surrey, and I knew I was in striking distance of London, so I thought, well, I'd get my uniform in London, which I did.
So where did you go to get yours?
Well, I consulted my father, because my father was an army officer, and I thought, well, he'd know. But he had no knowledge of Gives. Gives, of course, was the Pucker Naval Tailors, where I suppose I should have gone, really, but I didn't know that I was quite in that bracket. Anyway, my father was familiar with London. I wasn't so familiar. So he said, well, let's go along to, I think it was Simpsons. In the Strand, is it the Strand? I believe. I don't know whether they're still there, but it was a huge department store, specialising in uniforms, and I don't know whether he took me or whether I went on my own. But I presented myself to Simpson with my cheque for £55 or whatever, and they did the rest.
What did you have to kit yourself out with?
Oh. I don't, honestly. We had to have a great coat. We had to have obviously what we call number 5 uniform, which was the ordinary straightforward officer's uniform. I think we only had to have one of those. I don't think we had to have any sort of tropical. No, we wouldn't have had any tropical uniform. We had to have an officer's raincoat, and I think we had 2 caps, shoes and socks, and shirts and ties and that sort of thing. But it was all. I always remember the greatcoat because it was a beautiful thing, very, very nice, very, very heavy, and I regret that I didn't keep it.
And I take it that £52 covered.
£55. Well, I suppose it did. I have no real knowledge. I mean, that presumably that went into a bank. But I think I'd already opened a bank account before I joined up. So anyway, no checks bounced as I remember.
And what had it been like to get back and see your family? Obviously, now you'd been commissioned and you had your wings.
Well, obviously, I was very, very proud, very proud. And I think they were delighted, obviously, to see me home. I can't remember whether the father was actually around at the time. When I say that, don't get the wrong idea. But he was back in the army, obviously too old to go in frontline service. But he was on the staff, either at Eastern Command or wherever. So he was very proud that his son was now a naval officer. But what I do remember, of course, being a midshipman, I had no wavy gold ring. All I had was some crimson tabs on my collar and some wings on the left sleeve, which looked a bit bare. And I can remember we used to have the local village hall, and there was always a dance on a Saturday night, and we always perhaps felt we might find a few girlfriends or something at the dance, so I'd go along with an old school friend to the Saturday night dance, and I was dancing with this young lady, and she sort of said to me, "Well, what are you then, you see?" So I said, "Well, what do you think I am?" She said, "I think you're a petty officer in the Merchant Navy." And I thought, well, that was a bit of a letdown, because I was a Royal Navy officer, albeit a very junior one. So I didn't cut any ice there. But I suppose that's what we all thought as naval officers. We were going to be the V's knees. The other wonderful thing I remember is in those days, that the officer's cap badge was made out of gold wire, a very lovely thing, of course, and you know, most attractive thing, the cap badge on that went on your peak cap. But in those days, there was a bit of a shortage of these, and the standard issue was a metal thing, which was the same shape, and in the distance you wouldn't have known the difference, but it was like a bit of old tin. And of course we abhorred these things, and I wouldn't have anything to do with this. But anyway, there's a bit following on from there. When we finally, our leave was over, and we had to report back. Where do we have to report back to? Back to Bootle in Liverpool. So I can remember standing on the train at what would have been Euston or whatever London terminus it was, and we various coarse chums sort of appeared, you know. We all looked at one another, because none of us looked anything like we had done when we last met. And there was this one poor wretched youth who'd got his commission. And he was always a bit scruffy, but there he turned up, and he'd got one of these metal cap badges, and we told him to go away and get lost, and he couldn't understand why we turned our backs on him.
So you went back up to Macaw?
We went back up to Macaw. All the way up there, and of course, as I think we've said before, and travelling by train in wartime England took forever, and it wasn't terribly comfortable. But this time, of course, we were officers, so we went in first class. But that seemed to be more crowded than the third class. So I don't remember that it was a particularly comfortable journey. So we go back to Macaw. And we thought, well, here we are. We're fully trained naval aviators. We've got our wings. We're now officers. Oh, now life begins, you see. But life didn't begin. Nobody had a clue what to do with us. I mean, it was obvious that I don't know whether the Navy was overtrained or what, but certainly there was no immediate call for us to go and join a squadron or continue our training or anything. So we hung around in Bootle for another week or two, absolutely bored, nothing to do, no courses organised or anything, and I mean, all we could do was sort of find books to read and that sort of thing. And there was a pub, which had got an upstairs room with a bar, and I think we used to go in there for the sole reason, and it all seems rather sad now, that why did we go in an upstairs bar away from the public? And that was because the few of our friends who were petty officers, of course, we no longer mixed on the camps. They were separated from it, which was so sad. Once you got into a squadron, it was a different sort of atmosphere, but now this was very much them and us. So we went in this upstairs bar in this pub because they could be with us and we could be with them, and nobody could say we were doing wrong things. But it was rather a sad time, and it was wet and it was damp and it was misty. It was a miserable time. So what did they then decide to do with us? I can see you're hanging on my every word. They put us on a train and sent us all the way back down to London. And why did we come back to London? To send us to the Royal Naval College at Greenwich. The officers, that is, went back. We came. And why did we come there? Because we did what was known as the knife and fork course. You've heard all this before. the idea was that we had to be taught table manners. And we had to learn how to pass the port. How to be waited on at table. And we dined in the Painted Hall, which of course is absolutely magnificent. And it was just the whole naval atmosphere suddenly enveloped you, and you then began to realise that being a naval officer, even as a midshipman, did mean an awful lot. We were waited on at table by Wren stewardesses. They had white coats, starched white coats, very, very smart. They wore white gloves. And you imagine, you know, you've come from our sort of background and you've been scruffy sort of sailors, and you're suddenly being waited on and you had to learn to serve yourself, and they brought this around. And the senior officers, the captains, sat at top table. And the sub-lieutenant sat down the outsides of the aisles, there were sprigs, the tables, and the midshipman sat in the middle, so we had our backs to the top table. And the other thing I remember about Greenwich, well, several things I remember, ice cream. We had ice cream. Now, you couldn't get ice cream in wartime land, but we had ice cream. We had wonderful food. We learned how to peel an orange. How do you peel an orange? All these things which seem so...
How do you peel an orange?
With great difficulty. You slice it into sections with a knife, just the skin, and you peel the skin back in sections, and then you break the end... Oh, man. You didn't cut it in half and suck it as you and I would now. That was for sure. Anyway, while we were there, we had lectures, of course, naval history, tradition, how to behave when you joined a ship. It was all Navy, nothing to do with flying. This was real, how to behave as a naval officer. As you went into the Painted Hall, there was this huge, great, long oak table, which is still there, I believe, I imagine it is. And that the story is, this was where Nelson's coffin was rested when they brought him back from Trafalgar. And of course his body had been pickled in rum, as you've probably heard, and his coffin was all lined in lead. It must have weighed a ton. But this table was sort of sacrosanct. This was you know, a great something that the Navy held in great esteem, this table. When you walked in there to the painted hall, only the senior officers who'd got gold braid on their cap, they could put their caps on that table. The rest of us, all we scrubby little junior officers, had to put our caps anywhere we could find. And so you daren't put your cap on this table, otherwise you were for the high jump. So that was one thing. We had a very senior, elderly commander in charge of us, who had obviously been retired and brought back from retirement. A lovely old boy, can't remember his name, and he was like a housemaster, took charge of us, you know. And one of the lessons we learned unarmed combat, ready for when we were going to fight the Japs, I suppose. And he taught us this unarmed combat, this old boy. And we had with us a tall chap called Perry, I remember, about 6 foot something. He'd been a policeman, and he was now sub-lieutenant Perry. And we had to attack this old boy one by one, and he would throw us around, you know, jiu-jitsu, that sort of thing. And Perry, who thought he knew everything, being a policeman, he rushed at this commander, and before you knew where he was, Perry was flat on his back on the floor. And the commander stood over him and said, "Well, you can do better than that." And it was extraordinary. And I mean, despite his age, and he was fairly bulky, nobody could beat him. And if you held back because you were respecting his rank or his age, he said, "No, go at me, hit me, do what you can." And so we all tried, but we all ended up on the floor. But that was that. And then the other interesting about Greenwich was that while we were there, this was the first, what was it, February, March 1944, that there was a blitz in London. It was called, we call it now, the mini blitz. It was the last time Germany and Hitler were attacking London using conventional aircraft. This was their final fling. And they sent over some pretty intensive air raids at night. Now we, not every night, but when we were on duty, we had to do fire watching up on the roof of Royal Naval College, Greenwich. We had tin hats. I don't know what we were supposed to do if there'd been a bomb had dropped on us, but we obviously had some sort of drill. We were up there, and we watched these raids coming up the estuary. You could see where the planes were coming up. The anti-aircraft fire was absolutely intense. By that time of the war, we had really got it buttoned up. There was flak guns, there were shell bursts. We'd even got rocket-firing anti-aircraft guns. I mean, I was absolutely thunderstruck by all this tremendous barrage as they came up. Shell bursts everywhere. It was highly exciting. You know, almost as good as the firework displays we get now, you know. But it was an extraordinary experience. Now, as I say, we were there just a couple of 3 weeks, I don't know, not much more. I don't remember that we ever had any problem. We never had a bomb drop on us, and none of us lost our lives, thank goodness. We kept Greenwich College safe for those few weeks.
Did it look from you when you were in that vantage point when you were fire watching that they were aiming for any specific part of London?
I know, we couldn't really tell, but there were searchlights, there was every mortal thing. There was just this huge noise and barrage. I don't know how they weren't sending over the same number of planes as they had, you know, in 1940-41. But this was enough excitement for me.
Where were you accommodated at that time? Were you accommodated in the college?
In the college, yes, in cabins. We all had cabins. I think there were probably two of us to a cabin. Pretty well, it was an old building, as you understand. So it wasn't exactly full of all modern cons, but we were comfortable enough there. And the other thing was, which we couldn't quite really get to grips with, you put your shoes outside your cabin door, and they were polished by a steward or stewardess. Wasn't that extraordinary?
So would you say then, this period when you do the knife and fork course at Greenwich, did it do the trick of giving you that insight into the naval tradition, hierarchy, that you are a naval officer? Does it do that for you?
Well, it did me, very much so, because, I mean, bearing in mind, I'd come straight from school into the Navy, so it did mean an awful lot. But some of the more senior chaps, I mentioned Sub-Lieutenant Perry, who'd been a policeman, perhaps he didn't have the same feeling about it as I did. But, no, it was, I suppose it was the nearest thing I ever got to having been to a public school or university. It was a very life-changing episode.